Hey, ArtPod listeners, welcome back. I'm Kate Wells. I am your host, and this is the podcast from Michigan Radio where we talk about what's going on in Michigan's arts and cultural scenes. And right now, it's fall, obviously. You have noticed that if you've looked out your window. It's a beautiful season in Michigan. And the one thing I don't like about the days getting shorter, well, one of the many things I don't like about the days getting shorter, is that my body basically wants to go to bed around 7 p.m., maybe 8. I do my best to fight this. But if you feel like me, then you know that the one thing that you really start looking forward to as it gets cold is getting in bed, pulling up the covers, and reading something really, really good. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to really focus, obviously, on Michigan-centric books. And we're going to hear from two different authors. The first one is Keith Taylor. He's a poet and a good book fiend. We talk to him regularly here at Michigan Radio when we are looking to figure out what new books from Michigan we should be paying attention to. And he had his regular sit-down with Cynthia Canty on Stateside. They talked about his new picks. They're mostly books that focus on Michigan's Upper Peninsula. So take a listen.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, we have welcomed autumn here in Michigan, many of us with open arms. It's a beautiful, beautiful season in our state. And one of the pleasures of changing seasons is being able to talk with poet and writer Keith Taylor, who joins us now with his picks for our autumn reading books set in Michigan, written by Michigan writers. Keith, good to have you back as always.
Thanks, Cindy. It's
so,
a pleasure to be here.
What have you brought from us, and also what you'll be reading from, because having you read to us is one of my personal great pleasures here on Stateside.
And it's fun to do. I thought about, we were talking about this, I thought maybe I'd focus on the UP this time.
Let's talk UP.
Everything having to do with the UP. There's a lot of things happening in the UP right now.
Yeah.
Literary things. People don't think about that, but it's true. There's a good writing program at Northern Michigan. There are three literary journals that I know of. So, yeah, and lots of writers either from the UP or going to the UP or still living there who are putting books out, which is great.
Great.
And there's a history of it. The UP, if we go back, Hemingway's great short story, one of the great short stories in American literature, The Big Two-Hearted River, one of the Nick Adams stories from the 1920s, the character, after being damaged by World War I, goes fishing alone in the Upper Peninsula to sort of get physical and spiritual healing. So, you know, there's been a history. One of the great Vietnam novels we have, Philip Caputo's Indian Country, begins and ends in the UP. Our own Jim Harrison has placed several novels there. But there are a bunch of homegrown things now, which is great. I could have picked a bunch of books to talk about, but I wanted to pick some different kinds of things. So I've got three of them.
Great.
I'd like to talk about.
Where are we beginning?
Let's start with the crime writer Steve Hamilton.
Let's.
Okay. Steve's a lot of fun. Like many crime writers, he writes a lot of books. Years ago, he created this fascinating guy named Alex McKnight. And Alex McKnight was a former Detroit cop wounded in a shootout on duty, a shootout that kills his partner. He's left with a bullet lodged close to his heart, so he gets disability. His wife is fed up with him, so he leaves and he goes to the Upper Peninsula. Again, just because he figures he can live there.
Sure.
He moves to Paradise, Michigan.
Okay.
Real town. You know, there may be people out there who don't know that we have Paradise in Michigan.
But we have it in the UP. It's near
we
to
do.
Prominent Falls, isn't it?
It is. Yes. Very close to Prominent Falls. First book in his series was called A Cold Day in Paradise.
Okay.
Lovely title.
And the title of this one?
The title of the new one is called Let It Burn. So Alex went up there to get away, but he couldn't get away, of course, because he's a detective. The crimes and the mysteries keep following him.
Okay.
And he has to live with it. So Steve's done pretty well. These books have won him big awards. He's made a lot. He's got enormous fans in the Eastern UP. I've traveled with him a little bit doing presentations in the Eastern UP.
He's a literary rock star.
Absolutely. I want to do things with Steve because, I get his audience, which is great. But in this book, Let It Burn, again, this is one that begins and ends in the UP, but most of it takes place in Detroit. Alex is drawn back in to one of the crimes he thought he solved, but it's still reverberating both in Detroit and in Alex's imagination. He hears that a man he caught and helped convict is about to get out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex, because he's never been able to forget the case, and he's just nagging feeling that there was a terrible mistake made, that not only did he help convict an innocent man, but that the real killer is still out there, still killing. So like all crime novels, and of course you don't want any spoilers. You can't give away spoilers for a crime novel. But there's always the unexpected twists and turns of plot. There's lots of action. He's got great dialogue. You know, our crime writers in Michigan, I think it's the tradition of the late Elmore Leonard now. They all have to have a good ear for dialogue, and Steve has that ear for dialogue.
Okay.
And most of them keep the physical description to a minimum. But and Hamilton paints it, the physical description of the Upper Peninsula very quickly, but he can often do it really well. And he can get that sense of both the beauty and the ominous nature of it all. It all happens there. I mean, I just wanted to share with you the very beginning of this novel. So this is from Let It Burn, brand new novel by Steve Hamilton. Summers die hard in paradise. The first time you live through it, and because this place still has the MI as part of the address, you might actually expect the summer to fade away slowly like it does below the bridge. Down there, on a crystal blue day in September, the sun shining hot and bright until it starts to go down, you might feel a slight note of coolness in the air, a note that makes you think of football and back to school and leaves turning and all those other bittersweet signs that the season is changing. Something so subtle you might even be forgiven for missing it the first time it happened, especially if you didn't want the summer to end. Up here, on the shores of Lake Superior, there's a cold wind that gathers at the north and picks up weight as it builds its way across 200 miles of open water. And then, on a late afternoon in August, hell, sometime in July, that wind hits you square in the face and makes its intention quite clear. No matter how much you might not like the message, summer may not be 100% done, not just yet, but it's been mortally gut shot, and it's only a matter of days until it's gone.
What a perfect passage for this time of
year.
Isn't
that fun? Yeah.
I have to say, I did jump onto authorstevehamilton.com, onto his website.
He's got a good website.
He does. And that excerpt from chapter one, it struck me that he's very good in the sense that I know this is a series. I'm not familiar with the other ones, but I didn't feel left out of the party.
Yeah, he's found the way of handling that. You can jump into any of his novels. He's going to give you just enough background on Alex McKnight so you get the sense of the character, but you don't need it. Every one of those books stands alone, and everyone is different, so they're great that way. On the other hand, if you do get committed to this book and you want to read all 10 novels, it's great because the character develops and changes. So he's kind of figured out a way to have his cake and eat it too.
That's good. A good writer. So that is authorstevehamilton.com is his website. I'm just tell everybody who wants to find out more about Let It Burn by UP writer Steve Hamilton.
Yep.
Next we have
this novel is a couple years older, but I've always wanted to talk about it and haven't, so I'm going to now. It's by a woman named Ellen Ergood. It's called South of Superior. It just takes place just a few miles west along the coast of Lake Superior. She calls her fictional town McAllister, but if you know Grand Marais, it's clearly Grand Marais, and that is where she lives.
Okay.
She had to make the town a little bit bigger than Grand Marais, needed a larger cast of characters to fill it out. I mean, Grand Marais is tiny. I think there's maybe 300 people in greater Grand Marais, and so she needed a little bit bigger, but the physical location is exactly the same. If you know, at the end of the road, surrounded by forests and swamps on three sides, and then that beautiful bay on the south shore of the largest body of fresh water in the world. Ellen herself, she lives there. She went there 25 years ago. She married the guy who owned the diner. They've been running that diner ever since, and she works, 80 hours a week this woman works.
So she's really a part of the fabric of the community.
She absolutely, and she knows them all, and it's kind of amazing. For months in the winter, they have to go to work on a snowmobile. But all this time, she's been doing all that work. She's so involved in the business and in her community. She's been writing all the time. And I'd love to figure out how she finds the time to keep it going. But she has managed to do it. Now, in this novel, South of Superior, a young woman, Madeline Stone, returns to the place of her birth after years spent down in Chicago. She needs to go back there to get over the bitterness that she feels about her upbringing and her sense that the parents abandoned her. Now, that just it just hit me that we've got a little motif here of people going to the UP to get psychologically or spiritually healed. I mean, it's probably a variation on this American thing about we go to the woods to be cleansed. To be cleansed, right, or hit the river or hit the road. But the interesting that the
just
Upper
like
Peninsula
Whitman.
Has that. Although, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And that seems to have fit a pattern for some people. Now, of course, the UP, there's some nasty things that go on there. It's not always a positive place,
sure.
but and the truth will have to be told about that, or is told about that. But nonetheless, they go there, as does Alan Ehrgood's character, Madeline. Now, there she finds people who need her, two little old ladies who have lived all their lives there and who are getting frail and very aged. They need her, a child who has ended up alone, not necessarily abandoned, but who's ended up alone, and he needs his support group. And then in addition to that, she finds good work. She finds good work running in a old hotel on the edge of abandonment, and it'll provide a living for her and help preserve the sense of the place. So I was thinking about what to read. There's so many things I could read in there, and I'd love to read things about her dealing with the people, but those get a little long. So I hear I did a physical description, too. Now, this is a thing from early in the novel, early in South of Superior by Alan Ehrgood, where the character Madeline Stone is just arriving at this town, at McAllister, modeled on Grand Marais. And this description is just purely Grand Marais. You drive north on this road from Sini, what, 45 miles or so. It goes straight north through the swamps, and there's nothing else there but this tiny little town. If you've never been, I recommend it. It's gorgeous. So this is the view as she arrives. This is in April. The town sat at the base of a steep hill at the edge of the water, a lonely collection of buildings she could take in all in one glance from the distance. Huddled under the sleet that had been falling for hours, it looked stark and desolate and beautiful. I can interrupt myself here for a minute, Cindy.
Yeah.
Huddled under the sleet, it looked stark and desolate, period, and beautiful, period. And, you know, I think
rhythm,
absolutely. And also, I think there are a lot of people in the world who can't imagine that. Sleet, stark, desolate, beautiful.
I'm there.
Okay.
I get it.
I mean, it's a real Northern Michigan thing, or at least a Northern thing. It looked stark and desolate and beautiful. There was still snow on the ground, had been for the last 20 miles, and small icebergs bobbed near shore, waves lashing over them. Madeline had read that Lake Superior was as big as the state of South Carolina. It looked like an ocean. Without it, McAllister might have been any of the small, drab hamlets she'd driven through today. With it, and from this vantage point high above, the effect was somehow thrilling.
Love it.
And
the sense of place.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Fabulous.
And in this book, maybe even more than in the Steve Hamilton novels, in this book, it's clearly the sense of place. She clearly wants to write about the people who are around her.
Let me ask, does this kind of novel, I just finished one when I was on vacation, that it was good and it was some kind of thing, somebody coming home, and it kind of devolved into a romance, probably good for lying by the beach. But does this stay, where does this go?
I don't like that phrase chick lit, but what you described almost sort of is what people mean by chick lit.
Yeah.
No, this book is decidedly not chick lit. Okay. I mean, yes, it is about a woman. There's a love interest, although it's not, it doesn't dominate things. It's mostly about the relationship of her and these two old ladies and boy, the child, who's a little 5-year-old boy. On the other hand, I'm old enough now to cry shamelessly. And
appreciate a little love.
it's not love. I mean, this relationship between her and these two women, it was just like, yes, I remember that. I remember seeing that in my life, that people helped each other genuinely without money and, without all these things that get in the way. And she's writing about that, and she's writing about it awfully well, I think.
If you've just joined us, we are doing our seasonal check-in with the wonderful Keith Taylor, poet and writer, bringing us his picks for our autumn reading. So we've talked about Steve Hamilton's murder mystery, Let It Burn, Ellen Ehrgood's South of Superior, and where do we go next?
We have one other book to talk about, and this is, there may have been little regional anthologies, general anthologies of Upper Peninsula work that have been done in the past. But this is the first one I know of. It was published in the Wayne State series called Made in Michigan. It's edited by a really interesting guy named Ron Reike. It's called The Way North, and the subtitle is Collected Upper Peninsula New Works. 44 people in there, some poets, some short story writers. It's mostly the bulk of the book is fiction, but there are some very lovely poets in there. And it's the first time that I have seen this kind of thing done specifically about the Upper Peninsula. Now, so there are people who are from the UP and have left. There are people who have ended up moving to the UP as much to teach in one of those universities as anything else, although there are a couple who have simply moved there to and are trying to work in their writing. I have to admit that there are a few of us who have just traveled through. I've got a tiny little poem in here. Lots of the seasonal, lots of nature things, although I have to admit it's an anthology that is filled with snow and ice, and part of me likes that. I have to say the editor, this guy named Ron Reike, is just – he's a sort of indefatigable promoter of – or advocate rather than – that's better. Advocate of Upper Peninsula writing. He's edited this anthology. He's got a couple more coming out. He organizes tours and discussions. He doesn't hide the fact that there are lots of troubles in the UP, ones that reflect American society in general, rural poverty, drugs, racism in the UP, that being primarily directed against Native people. So that or racial tension because of that. But all the way through it, he has the sense, and he does, he finds this these things. He has the sense that there are stories to be told there, and maybe they're just a little bit different because of the location, because of the lack
above
of
the bridge,
because of the above the bridge. And that's a great thing to see. It's hard to pick out something here because it's just an anthology. Is it
all poetry, Keith?
It's just the first
short stories.
It's probably only the first 70 pages or so are poems. And then the last 200 are fiction, short stories, which include short stories by Ellen Ergood and Steve Hamilton. So he's found these people, too. But there's a wonderful poet and fiction writer named Jonathan Johnson who lives out west somewhere, but he's from Marquette, and I think he goes back to the UP as much as possible. And he wrote the introduction to this. In that introduction, he's kind of put his finger on what's unique about it. I just wanted to share a couple of passages from that introduction because I think Jonathan Johnson has found the sense of things. So this is from the introduction to The Way North, which is edited by Ron Reike, although this passage is by Jonathan Johnson. The Upper Peninsula is the most intimate landscape I know. And you got to say he spent his childhood there. So we all have this landscape of childhood. We all feel this intimacy. So no matter where we grow up, but for Johnson, it's the UP. The most intimate landscape I know. The woods are dense and close. The mountains low and old. The rivers narrow and mostly quiet. Most of the lakes are small and dusky and dark. The tavern ceilings are low and the cabins tight around their wood stoves. All but a few of the cemeteries and neighborhoods have aged back into their leafy habitats, and shabby and gentrified storefronts collect, closed-shouldered, into outposts and a few little downtowns, each no more than a handful of lights glimpsed from the crest of a highway at night. A couple paragraphs later, and sooner and later, it's going to snow. The most intimate weather of this intimate place. Snow will transform what you thought was the endlessness around you into a space that just fits your longing, your loss, your solitude.
I'm sold.
Isn't that lovely?
That is absolutely wonderful. So that is The Way North, edited by Ron Reike. Wonderful choices. Also, Ellen Ergood's novel, South of Superior. As Keith said, it's been out a couple of years, but deserves the attention. And Steve Hamilton's Let It Burn, a good murder mystery that starts in the UP, comes to Detroit, and then what, back up again?
Back up to the UP, yep.
Poet and writer Keith Taylor coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. Promise that we'll see you for our winter reading list?
Thinking about it already.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, now we're going to change our mode a little bit, and we're going to hear from a woman named Natalie Berg. She just came out with a memoir, despite being very young, It's about how she, as an inexperienced Michigan girl, winded up taking an au pair job in Sweden. And you can figure out how it went from the memoir's title, which is Swedish Lessons, a memoir of sex, love, and indentured servitude, sort of. She also sat down with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who among us has not had the experience of plunging into something that sure sounded good on paper, but then the reality turns out to be anything but? So when life hands you that proverbial lemon, you could make lemonade or you could write a book. And that's exactly what my next guest has done. Michigan writer Natalie Berg had a spectacularly bizarre experience living on a farm in Sweden, working as an au pair for a spectacularly bizarre family. And she turned all of that into a new book she calls Swedish Lessons, a memoir of sex, love, and indentured servitude, sort of. Great title. And by the way, that is S-E-C-T-S, not S-E-X. Natalie Berg joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia.
So there you were. You're living in East Lansing. You're trying to launch your writing career, and you're trying to keep this problem-filled relationship tottering along. What landed you in the middle of a huge farm in the middle of nowhere in Sweden?
Great question. I ask myself that all the time. I was at one of those points in life, I think a lot of us come to it in our early 20s, where I was done with college. I hadn't found that adult job yet. I was a part of a romantic relationship that had just ended, and I felt like I was just in between. And I happened to be having lunch with a new step relative of mine, and I was meeting this person for the first time and chatting about being kind of in this in-between area. And she said, oh my goodness, a friend of mine who lives in Sweden just told me that she was looking for a young American woman who's been to college to come and work as an au pair in her home. And I thought, wow, I am so qualified for that position. And that
I'm up
was
for an adventure.
Right. Yes. And it was kind of, am I ever going to go run overseas any other time in life? Probably not. So why not try it now?
So you exchanged some emails with the mother at the Swedish family. And what did those emails portend? What did you think you were getting into?
Well, in general, I was under the understanding that I would be living with this family for a year and that it would kind of be similar to a study abroad situation in which I'm part of the family and they're my host family. But I, instead of studying, I would be there to work as an au pair. There were three children. They lived on this working farm. And that she also said they travel, they have relatives in the south of France, we would go on these vacations, and they're just a train ride from the city. I could certainly go and spend my free time in the city. And then they would also pay for me to go to university to take Swedish courses as well.
I'd sign up for that in a heartbeat.
Me too. It sounds wonderful.
So this was in 2005. You headed over at what point in the year?
Well, it was about 6 weeks after that lunch where I first learned about it. I just dropped everything, quit my job, totally bailed on my roommate, and took off.
Off to Sweden.
Yes. And so this was early August or mid-August when I actually arrived.
So you arrive and you're greeted at the airport.
Yes.
By the mother.
Yes.
Whose name is?
Inger.
Inger.
That's what we call her in the book.
Yes, that's what we call her in the book. So clearly names have been changed to protect the guilty in this.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Except my own, who's probably the guiltiest person in the whole book.
So tell us a little about where you found yourself living and about the makeup of this family.
So I arrived and I was under the understanding that I was going to be on a farm. I got that. But I wasn't quite prepared just how extreme this farm situation was going to be. I grew up in a rural town up north, so I know farms.
Uh-huh.
This was a farm that was in the middle of nowhere. As far as the eye could see in every direction, there's just farm fields. There is a train station that is a few miles away, but that's the closest thing, really. This is a working farm that there's a large farmhouse where the family lived, and then little worker houses where workers lived in,
okay,
who actually worked on the farm, and their, you know, cows, horses, all these kind of things. And this is a functioning farm that was built in the early 1800s. So you kind of feel like you're playing pretend in this like historic Greenfield village
okay,
kind of a
yeah,
situation.
Yeah, little house on the prairie feel.
Right, right. And come to find out, when I arrived and woke up the next morning all sorts of jet-lagged and, mm-hmm. and whatnot, was the first time I really came face-to-face with the rest of the family who were teenagers, it turned out, to those children I was supposed to be a nanny for.
Oh, boy. Well, I'd like you, if you could read an excerpt and for us. And it's where you have sat there for your first breakfast with the family, and you're jet-lagged, and you've got husband, wife, and three kids, and the only one really talking is mom.
Sure. And I should give a disclaimer that I am horrible with accents. I should be good because I live there. But when it comes out, it's usually something between like a British accent or like Japanese. Okay. So sorry, but I try anyway. And this is Inger speaking. So, how was your rest, darling? Did you sleep well in your new bed? To picture Inger properly, imagine Ronald McDonald's sister, sans the makeup job. She was tall and thin with a round head and even rounder red poof of hair. And her mouth, oh, her mouth, it was almost as crazy looking as the stuff that would later come out of it. It was broad and redder than her hair and almost constantly poised in the largest smile you've ever seen. Her unique features hadn't made such an impression the day before when she was fetching me from the airport. Between the jet lag and listening to her life story for 3 hours, all details were a little blurry. I did recall noting her candidness was a good sign, however. I was going to be a part of the family, after all, so I appreciated her willingness to share on any topic that entered her head. "We are a nation in transition," she'd said out of nowhere at the airport, briefing me on Sweden's national identity before diving right back into another personal narrative about her youth. She went on to describe her parents as stuffy, money-grubbing Swedes who spent their lives avoiding the true meaning of living. My mother, she never worked outside the home a day in her life, but would not have survived without a maid, she laughed. Ha ha! Every inch of the floor and window was scrubbed clean each day, and never was a linen out of place. I nodded along, tearing hungrily through the dry baguette she'd ordered me from the cafe. But in Sweden, each generation finds itself so differently to the past. We are a household in motion. I think of what my mother would say as I step over piles of clothes on the stairway or whatever the children have left behind. Life is too much, too important to worry about such details, correct? Excellent. I could not have been more pleased with this explanation, as regardless of having been hired to assist with domestic duties, I wasn't much of a housekeeper. It seemed we had this in common. I just want to tell you that you are so welcome here, she said again at the breakfast table, leaning forward, her forearms resting on the edge of the tabletop, grinning like she was eating shit nut eggs. So welcome. Oh, thank you. I was so confused. Why was she still telling me this? Like there should be some doubt about my state of welcomeness. You told me to come, woman. Did someone here not feel I was so welcome? And again, why were these kids teenagers?
Teenagers. So you thought you were coming over caring for kids, and
right.
You wind up having teenagers. Writer Natalie Berg's memoir about her time of great self-discovery while working as an au pair on a farm in Sweden. The book's called Swedish Lessons. So it didn't take too long, did it, before you realized things were not going to be working out as you had thought? No trips to the south of France, no train into town. Give us an idea of the kinds of chores that were quickly loaded onto you.
Well, the impression that I was given at the beginning was here are some kind of household duties that we'll just give you these because they're easy at first. And then as you understand what I do for a living, she tells me, then your job will sort of evolve. So I start having this full week itinerary of vacuuming and dusting and taking the horses out for a walk in the morning and taking the dogs for a walk in the morning. It's basically what a maid does. Mm-hmm. And just as I was beginning to feel a little frustrated with this and think, okay, this is not really what I signed up for.
No daycare, no childcare in here.
right. There was the occasional like piano lessons for the kids. But, you know, they're teenagers. Last thing they want to do is hang out with another mom.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing a lot of these household duties, and then she finally sat me down about 3 weeks in to tell me about what it was that she did for a living.
And that was?
She was starting what had amounted to her own franchise of this religious cult type thing. And she sat me down and showed me a VHS tape that was more or less a kind of recruitment video for this religious philosophy. And that is when things really kind of went off the rails.
And continued to go off the rails. In what way?
Well, I didn't have much of an interest, it turns out, in her little cult. So she not only, you know, not only did I retain all of those household duties, but more and more kept being added on. So as my hours of the day were really packed full, I also realized that being a part of the family really didn't involve them helping with any living expenses. So all the money they were giving me was going towards my living expenses. So when I did have a weekend, I couldn't afford to go to the city. Or so I use the term sort of tongue-in-cheek, indentured servitude, but kind of technically what it was.
You got down to a point where you were actually having to squirrel bits of food away.
I was. When I finally found a friend who I could go visit from time to time, then I was stuck with the how do I feed myself when I'm not just taking food out of the kitchen. So I'm like stealing cans of tomatoes.
You know, when I, as someone who, as a college age kid, went away and did a year in Ireland, and I know there were times I remember I had to decide, could I afford to buy orange juice this week? And I bought a bicycle, but then I had to sell it because I needed it for living expenses. But it wasn't desperate, and I wasn't isolated. But you had the internet, and which I did not have back in my time in Ireland. Was there a point where you wanted to say, help, I need to get out, I want to come home, I'm stranded? Or did you let the folks back here in Michigan know how bad things were?
Oh, of course not. I was having a magical adventure overseas.
Was that pride?
Yes.
Young
well,
lady?
there were several things that were keeping me there, one of which was pride. Here I had ditched a job. It was a costly endeavor to get myself overseas, which my family helped me with. And I'd left a certain number of people hanging, just being like, oh, I'm going to go to Sweden. How could I say no to this incredible experience? Also, from the beginning of the book, you're aware that I had just extracted myself from a really unhealthy relationship. And at this point in my life, I couldn't really define what was wrong with it, why it felt so hard to get out of. But I was genuinely worried about if I went back, I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to not get back in it. I didn't know how to continue without it. So I partially was trying to just stay away. Okay. For that reason, and which is no healthier, I don't think, than having gone back to face it. But what did I know? I was 23.
Sure.
So and there was also a monetary thing. I was kind of tied there, and I didn't want to cost anyone else any more money. And it would have cost people money just to get me home.
And you just thought, all right, I can make this happen for a year.
And I kind of thought it would get better. You know, yeah. I always have this kind of annoyingly relentless optimism in the face of common sense that kept me thinking, it's going to get good now.
So what most surprised you about Sweden, and particularly the Swedish?
I was really stunned by how nearly every Swede I met, the first thing they asked me was, what do Americans think of Sweden? And I thought, gosh, I'm so embarrassed to tell you that I don't think we think much about Sweden. Sorry.
Unless you're a Red Wing fan and you're right. Cheering for Zetterberg.
Right. Yeah. In fact, a consistent problem I had when corresponding with people back home is they were confused whether I was in Sweden or Switzerland, which is sort of mind-blowing to me one way or the other. But you know, they're so focused on American culture, as much of the world is American pop culture. And there are a few people that I met were very preoccupied with American pop culture. They're kind of heartbroken. They know everything about us, and they're kind of heartbroken that we don't really have an opinion of them.
Okay. The winter wears on, and the homesickness is becoming pervasive, and you and your friend, is it Johan?
Oh, Johan.
Johan. Yes. We're listening. You love to listen to music, and he says, come, I have a song for you, and it turns out to be the Simon and Garfunkel song, America. And you thought of it as, oh, yeah, just another 60s folk ballad.
Sure. We quietly listened to the rest of the song together. Kathy, I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. The duo hummed through all four ears in the room. I wondered how differently the lyrics, the guitar, and the very ethos of Simon and Garfunkel fell on his ears than mine. Michigan seems like a dream to be now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've gone to look for America. My heart, the actual organ in my chest, leapt in reaction to the lyrics. I may have heard them dozens of times before, but they had never meant anything. Here, in this little Swedish village, in the presence of this mysterious foreigner who had become my only ally in a hemisphere, it was suddenly the most powerful song I'd ever heard. This was a song about my home. Michigan did seem like a dream to me now. The mitten-shaped state happened to be where I had spent most of my first 2 decades of life, but now that I wasn't there, it felt like so much more. I finally felt connected to it, knowing just what it meant to be so far from it. Looking out the window, I noticed for the first time since I had arrived in Sveria that Michigan was so physically far from me. I could not walk there. I could not hitch a ride there. No one could hitchhike to me.
So you did finally come home. And in hindsight, Natalie Berg, are you glad you did this? Are you glad you had this experience on the farm in Sweden?
It's one of those things that is hard to say, like, yeah, I'm so glad that I made all of those horrible mistakes. But between having a book that I was able to write about it, and also the book is called Swedish Lessons, and in retrospect, looking at my life, I had some really hard lessons to learn about myself and my relationships with people. And I don't know how I would have learned those if I had been in my kind of protective bubble here, mm-hmm. in where I've grown up and have always had so many resources to help me. So it's certainly, I wouldn't be the person I am today for sure without it.
And if, to anyone considering a similar au pair adventure, what would your main advice be?
Oh, I can't believe I'm about to say this, but I would take the advice of my father, who told me before going that I needed to check the references from past au pairs because they had past au pairs. And I can guarantee what that woman would have told me had I found her. Really, just if something sounds too good to be true, I mean, take 5 minutes and Google it at the very least. Just a little more preparation. And especially since I was making all of these decisions blindly, basically with my heart and my ambition. I don't know, sometimes your brain is helpful.
I'm curious, have you been in contact with a family at all since you came back in 2006?
No, I have not.
No. And names have been changed, so they don't really even know about this book, do they?
Oh, I don't know, and I don't really want
to. Oh, my word. Natalie Berg is the Michigan writer whose memoir is called Swedish Lessons, a memoir of sects, love, and indentured servitude, sort of. Very, very enjoyable book, and thanks for coming in and talking with us, Natalie.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Now, if none of these ideas give you the good reading hit that you're looking for, go ahead and check out this podcast on our website at michiganradio.org. We are linking you to lists of some of the best books by Michigan authors in the last year. And in the comments section, that's when we want to hear from you. We want to know what you're reading right now. Specifically, we want to know what Michigan authors you're big on right now. Is there a new book that's come out that you just cannot get enough of? That's what we're looking for. So this is it for us today, but make sure you send us those book ideas. Go online, michiganradio.org. And while you're there, make sure that, as always, you are sending us your stories and your ideas. I'm Kate Wells. Thanks for listening.